since the Masters. I'm Dave Anthony, Fox News Radio.
You're listening to 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com, the official stations of New Rock City, the place where you can enjoy a wholesome family entertainment experience.
There's a Thursday morning forecast from Westchester County and Missouri. High pressures across New England extending down across the mid-Atlantic states. That'll keep us into a north breeze today, and then with plenty of sunshine, low comfortable relative humidity, and our high temperatures will range into about the middle 80s. But it will be clear tonight. Or overnight, low temperatures back into the upper 50s, although if you're out and about this Thursday evening, expect temperatures to hover close to between 72 and 77, at least up until about 9 or 10 p.m. Friday's weather back to mostly sunny conditions. The south wind tomorrow will drive temperatures a touch warmer into the mid-80s, but nothing like we had earlier this week. At night, it'll be mostly clear. At nighttime, low temperatures back into the lower 60s. Saturday, sunshine to becoming partly sunny. Maybe a later day shower or thunder shower. With their high temperatures in the mid-80s on Saturday. Now, Sunday, Father's Day, looks like we get into a clearing trend. Sunny to partly sunny in the lower 80s. Fair skies for Monday. Monday's highs from 75 to 80 as well. I'm Andy Rogers, Steve Pelletieri for WVOX and WVIP, the Whitney Radio Network.
The latest forecast from the 1460 WVOX Weather Center. Brought to you by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center. Right for New York.
At Entergy. Meeting our region's need for reliable, affordable, and clean electricity is an everyday success story. That's because our Indian Point Energy Center supplies up to 38% of the region's power needs. It also produces some of the least expensive power generated in the region. And most importantly, it does not produce greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, zero greenhouse gases. This plays a key role in helping this area improve its air quality. So it should come as no surprise that a growing number of environmentalists, including Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, say nuclear power is a vital tool in the fight against global warming. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.safesecurevital.com. Because the more you know, the more you realize that Indian Point's clean, reliable, and affordable energy is a big part of the climate change solution.
1460 WVOX. Good morning, and welcome to Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Lebensold, your host for this series on the natural world, education, and culture. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, June 12th, 2008, the 85th day of spring. Next up, summer in 9 days on Saturday, June 21st. We have gained 1 minute of daylight since yesterday, 23 minutes since last we met 3 weeks ago. You may notice that although days continue lengthening, their pace is slower as we approach the summer solstice a week from Saturday. Next time we meet in 2 weeks, daylight will have begun to shrink, although not noticeably until late summer. Although we round off to minutes and an anomaly of the chart indicates a 1 minute increase when next we meet, that will not be the case. On and around the solstice, days are pretty flat and all are very close to the longest of the year. But the actual longest is at the moment of the solstice when the sun's ecliptic, that is its apparent path, touches upon the Tropic of Cancer at 23.5 degrees north latitude and begins its inexorable path toward the equator, as it has since time began and will continue long after I and you and everyone and everything else you know is gone. The sun rose at 5:23 this morning. It will set at 8:28 this evening. We will have 15 hours and 5 minutes of daylight today, and the longest day of the year on the solstice will be 15 hours and 8 minutes, so just 3 minutes longer than today. We are just about the longest right now, so enjoy all that light. The moon will rise at 3:03 this afternoon. It will set at 1:57 tomorrow morning. We are 2 days past first quarter. Next full moon is on June 18th, and here is a flash from the Naval Observatory, and this was news to me. It will probably be news to you, even though it has been in effect for some time. Excuse me. The observatory at Greenwich, south of London, is now a museum and not an active observatory. Therefore, Greenwich Mean Time, which we have known as GMT, is no longer the correct nomenclature. What used to be GMT is now known as Coordinated Universal Time. Next high tides in New Rochelle at 8:02 p.m. in Yonkers at 5:50 p.m., Dobbs Ferry 6:18, Tarrytown 6:34, and in Peekskill at 7:13 p.m. Now for our regular feature, the sad feature, names of American service members who have lost their lives in Iraq. May they live on in all of our hearts. To date, there have been 4,091 American deaths. I say to date, we're a few days behind. Hopefully it has not increased, but I don't have much hope for that. There have been 4,091 American deaths, 12 more than at our last broadcast, and tens of thousands more with grave physical and or mental injuries. The casualties, whom we would like to honor today for their service to our country, Private First Class Joshua E. Waltenbaugh, age 19, from Ford City, Pennsylvania. He was killed on June 3rd in a non-combat-related incident. Also a non-combat incident, and I wish I knew what these things were. Do they have car accidents, bar fights? What's non-combat in Iraq? I really don't get this. If anybody does get it, please drop me a line. Specialist Quincy J. Green, 26, of El Paso, Texas, also non-combat. Specialist Christopher D. McCarthy, we don't know his age. He was a reservist, which means he did not sign up for the war. He signed up for benefits, basically, but that's the way it goes. He's from Virginia Beach, Virginia, died in Tikrit on June 1st. The cause of his death is under investigation. Specialist Justin R. Mixon, age 22, of Bogalusa, Louisiana, died on June 1st when a roadside bomb hit his vehicle in Baghdad. Specialist James M. Finley, age 21, of Lebanon, Missouri, and Private Andrew J. Shields, 19, of Battleground, Washington, both of whom were killed when their vehicle encountered a roadside bomb in Jalalabad City, Afghanistan, on May 31st. Both of these soldiers were highly trained men from the 173rd Airborne Brigade Combat Team, and where will they be when we really need them to defend our country? All of these men were alive when last we met, and unless we have a miraculous fortnight, others who breathe air today won't then. Each life is a treasure and a tragic loss to us all. May these American servicemen live forever in our hearts, and may this feature come to an end in the very near future, because there are no more deaths to report. Time for the Culture Corner, my reviews of plays, ballets, opera, museums, and what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions, and you have the right to differ from them, because everyone has the right to be wrong. Okay, I have a bunch of reviews today, so I am going to make short shrift of the movie Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Harrison Ford is back, yes. He's a little older, but just as good as ever. What I can say about this is I enjoyed it because I enjoy Harrison Ford. I think he's a good actor. I like his persona, and I like the adventure. If you like this kind of adventure, you'll kind of like it too. The story is beside the point, really. I never follow what causes these chaoses or motivates these characters. When I try, my brain hurts. You just can't really follow it. You get the humor, you get the adventure, you don't have to work that hard. When in a maelstrom, sit back and enjoy the ride. So it's a Spielberg film, so you know it's got quality direction. And if you like this kind of thing, by all means, see it. If it's not your genre, don't bother, because it won't grab you. It's like the Star Trek movies. I had to see them all several times because I'm a Star Trek guy. But if you were not, you probably would have liked just the one of them, the Wrath of Khan, and the others you'd say, what the heck is they trying to do here? Okay, now I also would like to review Jackie Mason. His program on Off-Broadway is called The Ultimate Jew. Jackie Mason's latest and last one-man stand-up act is redundantly titled the ultimate Jew, because everyone knows who he is. He's a consummate professional, too. I wasn't thrilled with the first half. Much of the show was recycled humor from The World According to Me, which I have listened to on tape more often than I would care to admit to. The jokes and Mason's impeccable delivery are hilarious, of course, but when you go to the theater, you want new material. There is some here, but Jackie early on seemed to take the audience for granted, acting kind of like your funny old Jewish uncle who makes everybody laugh at the Passover Seder. And if you're not Jewish, I'm sure on St. Patrick's Day, your funny Catholic Irish uncle serves the same function in your family. It seemed lazy to me, although he got more laughter than he worked for. He kind of took the audience for granted. There were flashes of his brilliance of observation, style, and delivery, which proved he still has it. But why not spend the extra energy writing fresher jokes? Anyway, the audience's enthusiasm and response finally got to him, and he did bring out the good stuff. Every entertainer knows the basic rules. Always leave them laughing if you're a comic, and always leave them wanting more. Time was growing short, and that was when Jackie Mason, the ultimate Jew, capital J, capital M, capital U, capital J, emerged on stage. His last hilarious routine caused uproarious laughter, and when it was done, while the theater was rocking with laughter, just when we wanted more, he said goodnight. So professional, yes, absolutely. Just a couple of other little things. Actually, a couple of other big things. I've seen two productions of the American Ballet Theater in the last week. Let's talk about Tuesday night's Don Quixote. These are performed by the American Ballet Theater at the Metropolitan Opera House in Lincoln Center. This one is staged by former dancer and artistic director Kevin McKenzie, and it's a funny ballet. Ballet is largely pantomime, and body language here was quite well done. The fact that comic moves are carried out by some of the best dancers in the world makes them all the more successful in eliciting humor. Classical narrative ballet, which this is, tells a story not just by the pas de deux and the chaînes and the dance steps, but by all manner of easily understood gestures. And in this work, it's done beautifully. And I got to make this comparison. You don't have to know any ballet to get the meanings here, but to go from the ridiculous to the sublime, one can compare certain moves with the Three Stooges. Okay, from the way ridiculous to the near sublime, a certain of the comedic slaps evoke those characters, however uncharacteristic a reference that may be in the context of a ballet review. Don Quixote and Sancho Panza are mere bit players in this program. The real stars are Angel Corella as Basilio, a poor barber, Marcelo Gomes as Espada, a famous matador, and the wonderful Paloma Herrera as Kitri, the what else? Girl who is betrothed to one other than the man she loves. So many ballets and operas have this theme. Love must conquer money and tradition and control and religion and family, anything and everything which stands in its way. Sometimes it does, as in this light piece, but often it doesn't, as in Swan Lake, Giselle, and of course the all-time classic romantic comedy, I'm sorry, all-time classic romantic tragedy, which has been made into both opera and ballet, Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. But here, thank goodness, Basilio and Kitri work it out with her buffoon father and buffoon betrothed accepting the inevitable and everyone living happily ever after, twirling and balancing endlessly on point, which, by the way, Ms. Herrera is really good at. She can stay up on that toe in great balance for, I didn't put a stopwatch on her, but quite a display. She got some very great, well-deserved applause. The principals are well supported by solo and core dancers. The sets and costumes are great. Now, with the American Ballet Theater, you generally get a fine show, and most of their programs, if you have a taste for dance, are well worth your while. One exception was, however, last week's Rabbit and Rogue, which was a Twyla Tharp piece. Twyla Tharp, a brand new world premiere by Twyla Tharp. There was little redemption in that one. The performers danced their little hearts out, but the choreography smacked of a world-famous seasoned veteran, this being Twyla Tharp, forgetting to take the bees and bats out of her bonnet and belfry, respectively. The music sucked. Can I say that in a ballet review? I guess if I can compare moves to the Three Stooges, I can say that. I imagine the dancers felt they had wasted their time learning all that choreography. I do enjoy modern music as much as standard classical and Baroque fare when it is well done, but this wasn't. ABT's dancers are great, as I've said many times, and how can one fault the administration for giving Ms. Tharp a venue for new work, given her long and storied choreography par excellence? Nowhere to put the blame, but I predict Rabbit and Rogue will never see the light of day after this premiere run. Now, as I say, this will be the end of it. As I say at the beginning of this feature, everyone is entitled to their own opinion because everyone has the right to be wrong. And boy, is New York Times reviewer Alistair McCauley wrong. His reputation precedes him. He is knowledgeable and can be mean-spirited, which is really not up to professionalism of any kind, certainly not the arts. There was a production of Etudes at the American Ballet Theater last week as well. To begin with, he says straight up that Etudes is ghastly and appalling, and that no matter who does it, no matter who performs it, is going to be that way. Well, all I can say, Alistair, is if you go in with that attitude, of course you will have a miserable, another quote, time and be way disappointed. Last time I stuck a sharp stick in my eye, I decided never to do that again. Surely there are other reviewers who could see a wonderfully danced exposition of ballet styles and skills through different eyes and give ABT's Etudes the complimentary review it much deserves. Etudes was great, I enjoyed it, and so apparently did the 3,799 other patrons. Maybe McCauley should get out on the streets of Harlem and watch some breakdancing and see what people really do. Like, for instance, like Mr. Bojangles, who had to work for tips, right? Rather than sitting in his stuffy ivory tower, whatever that is. Enough about him, because he was right on with Rabbit and Rogue. We agreed on that one. There are some challenging trumpet and flute riffs here in the Etudes score, and the orchestra was up to it. The lighting was a bit harsh at times, but not enough to distract uncomfortably. The staging was a bit awkward at times. And on the sides, lost some of the action to shadow. Some great dances by all the principals. That's it for the reviews today. I highly recommend American Ballet Theater anytime you can go there. Okay, I've made him wait long enough. My guest today is Martin Ogle, chief naturalist at the Northern Virginia Regional Park Authority, a position he has held since 1985. He holds degrees in wildlife biology from Colorado State University and Virginia Tech. He's presented more than 100 lectures and courses on the Gaia theory, much more about that, for universities and other audiences since 1990. He has met and talked with many of the top scientists in Gaia theory research, including Drs. James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis. And his meetings and correspondence with those two helped inspire the development of the Gaia theory conference. Welcome, Martin Ogle.
Well, thanks, Bob. I'm glad to be here.
Hi. Sorry I made you wait so long, Martin. I just saw so much last week, and I wanted to review it all.
I enjoyed your reviews.
Good. How is your weather in Virginia today, Martin?
Oh, much cooler than it has been the last few days. Much more comfortable.
Good. It's the way it is, too, up here. Let us begin by talking about Gaia. This is probably a new word for many of our listeners. What it means, the origins of the name and the theory, and its implications for our lives. Tell us about Gaia theory and your relationship with it.
Well, I came across the Gaia theory about two decades ago, and from my own standpoint, I saw it as the most complete ecology there was. If we're going to understand how our planet works, what's the best way to understand all the interrelationships? And Dr. James Lovelock developed this idea about 40 or 45 years ago, maybe longer, I'm losing track of time. And he kind of describes Gaia. There's no definitions per se, but he describes it as Earth seen as a single system, a single physiological system. And he says that just like any living organism, even including you and I, it self-regulates its chemistry and temperature and so forth.
So Gaia is when we think of the Earth, kind of the first thought is that it's a ball of rock, and on top of that ball of rock is water and life from plant life, and of course the smaller lives, plant life and animal life, which we know as the biosphere. So, but it's actually a system. It's not just a rock. And as I told you on the phone, I don't quite have the understanding that you and Jim Lovelock and Lynn Margulis have of it. I still struggle a little bit. It is a system which evolves with the life on it somehow. Can you clarify that even for me?
Sure. Rather than looking at our planet as a rock with life on it, it may be more accurate to say that our planet, at least at the surface, is a system made up of the rock, of the water and life and other things all interwoven together. In fact, they evolve together. One of the interesting descriptions of the Gaia theory, actually, from my standpoint, is long predates the actual idea of Gaia itself, but it was from a biologist from 1925, and he was talking about evolution, and he says it's not so much the organism or the species that evolves, but the entire system. So he's seeing the species and the environment evolving together as one unit.
Well, I certainly get that. We can also, I suppose, include in Gaia the weather systems and wind currents and salinity of water and all of that and volcanic eruptions. I mean, this is all Gaian, isn't it?
Yeah, in a very loose sense, I compare those kinds of things to things that might happen in our body, like we sweat and we metabolize at different rates and different things go on in different parts of our body. So similarly, if there's an organism-like system at the planetary level, then you'd expect those kinds of things to happen in a similar way at a larger scale.
Okay. The origin of the word Gaia. Now, Gaia was a Greek, I think the first goddess of all. It predates all the gods, the Earth Mother.
Do we know anything about the Greek goddess of Earth?
Excuse me?
The Greek goddess of Earth.
Goddess of Earth, and in fact, she was the mother and wife of Uranus.
That's right.
Yes. So we started being edible a very long time ago. And yeah. The name was suggested by William Golding, author of Lord of the Flies. What was the origin of that?
Yeah, I find that so fascinating, and right alongside the science, or perhaps even part and parcel of it, this social aspect is so fascinating. When James Lovelock returned from the United States working with NASA in the 1960s, early 70s, he was, of course, talking about his ideas, these early ideas of how life worked, with people he knew. And it just so happened that he and William Golding were neighbors in that part of England that he lived at the time. And as they discussed it, Golding was the one that actually suggested the name and said that it would honor our own Western traditions' views, early views of Earth as a living system. Mm-hmm. So we've kind of got our mythology lining up with our science in a way, and vice versa.
Interesting. Now, Jim Lovelock can be certainly considered an environmentalist. His whole being, I've met the gentleman, he's a gentle person, and his whole attitude is, what can we do with this Earth? Now, he has been very controversial in his last book, The Revenge of Gaia, about Earth's climate crisis and the fate of humanity. This book just came out, I think, 07 or something. I have it here. And he says that, it's an 06 book, he says that nuclear energy is actually a better way for us to go in the interim before we get to truly green energy, is better than burning all these fossil fuels. Now, that's been highly controversial. What's your take?
Well, just first with regards to his take on it, he is saying that for the biggest reason being we have to combat global warming, therefore try to find a way that we can generate the levels of energy we seem to need using some technology that generates less carbon dioxide. And in that regards, I not so much agree with him, but see it almost as an inevitability if, and I guess this is the if that's so important to me, if we continue to use energy at the same levels. I actually had the opportunity to meet and talk with Dr. Lovelock back in 2003, mm-hmm. back when he, shortly after he had kind of made this a public announcement, and I kind of concurred with his reasons for saying that nuclear would be a way to make a transition, but wondered aloud, what about the idea of conservation, meaning that can our society fairly quickly go towards using less energy and doing so without a crisis in mind. And his opinion is that it's a greater challenge to do that than it is to take care of the technical aspects of nuclear energy. My own thought is that, well, if we say it that way, then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. That is, if we just kind of throw up our arms and say that it's going to be impossible to reduce our energy use, then that will happen. But I think there's lots of opportunities that we can actually save energy in fairly quick order.
Okay. Martin, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Hold on, please. You are listening to AM 1460 WVOX in New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening in Cincinnati, Akron, or Steubenville, Ohio, Tuscaloosa, Dothan, or Birmingham, Alabama, or Birmingham, England, you have logged on to www.wvox.com. You are listening live. My guest is Martin Ogle. This is Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Lebensold, and we will take a short break and be right back.
This is the flagship station of Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com. Now, the latest update from Fox News Radio.
This is a Fox News alert. I'm Don Matheson. The U.S. Supreme Court deals a setback to the Bush administration. In a 5-4 ruling, justices say Guantanamo Bay detainees have legal rights. The High Court says 270 men being held at the prison have constitutional rights to challenge their detention in civilian courts. They are classified as enemy combatants and held on suspicion of terrorism or links to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Many of them have been held for 6 years or more. In Iowa, 4 scouts killed at a Boy Scout camp as a tornado hits the area. And in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, a levee giving way.
Police are going door to door, evacuating homes in parts of Cedar Rapids after a major levee breach. Water pouring over and through a levee into a neighborhood near the Cedar River. There have also been some minor breaches in other levees as the state's second biggest city deals with a historic flood.
Fox News Radio's Todd Starnes. This is a Fox News alert.
You know, many of us are increasing the value in our homes by doing home improvement. And I want to tell you about an important discovery we've made when it comes to home improvement here in Westchester County. His name is Armando Magana. Now, Armando and his crew of skilled workers are our recommendation when it comes to painting, carpentry, or really any home improvement project that you have either inside or outside of your home. You see, Armando is an expert in these projects, both big and small, that require the skill of a professional. So save your precious weekend or weekday time and let Armando fix up the look of your home at a price that's fair and reasonable. You can call Armando Magana at 914-224-6588 and you'll see why Westchester homeowners are raving about this personable home improvement expert. Armando Magana in Westchester, the Bronx, Queens, and Manhattan. Armando will come to you for a fast, free estimate. No job too big, too small. Armando Magana, 914-224-6588.
This is Bill O'Shaughnessy, and it's Bolfamonte season, as we call it here in Westchester. For years and years around here, Mario Bolfamonte and his sons, Stephen, Anthony, and Benny, have been the royalty of the landscaping and outdoor maintenance world, and I don't exaggerate a bit. Their marvelous new headquarters near the New Rochelle Humane Society off Fifth Avenue and off Potter is not the easiest place in the world to find, I can tell you, but it's the place individual homeowners go on their own for advice on everything that grows. And it's also the place professional landscapers take their clients to select plantings. The Mario Bolfamonte and Sons Garden Center is a Westchester treasure, and it's the perfect time right now for a visit with your landscaper or on your own. Call 914-636-4428 and ask for Anthony, Stephen, Benny, or the great Mario Bolfamonte himself for directions. I'm reminded the place is actually a few steps from the new Gundelax power equipment location, and it's only a few blocks from the radio station where I'm talking to you from right now. It's Mario Bolfamonte time again in the land, I tell you.
Here's the updated weather forecast for Westchester County and Vicinity. Look for sunny weather today. Temperatures ranging into the mid-80s on north winds at 5 to 15. It'll be mostly clear tonight with our nighttime readings back into the upper 50s. Then mostly sunny on Friday. Friday's highs middle 80s. Clear skies at night becoming partly cloudy overnight down into the lower 60s. And Saturday's looking mostly sunny, becoming partly sunny. Might be a late day or evening shower. Thunder shower mid-80s. Clearing up for Sunday with sunshine lower 80s. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX and WVIP, the Whitney Radio Network.
1460 WVOX.
We are back. Before we get back to our guest, Martin Ogle, I'd like to just tell you about my friends at The Learning Shop. The Learning Shop is a tutoring company, full-service tutoring company in Harrison, New York. It's when it comes to the summertime especially, they have a music program that will take your child, your grandchild, your friend, yourself, anybody, on a journey with talented working musicians, including singers, engineers, and songwriters. And as I have said many times, I know these people. These are not just people who give me something to read to you on the air. I know the musicians. I know how good they are, and they perform. Some of them, Chris Kuransky, I forget his last name exactly, but Chris travels around the world playing with his band. Some of the singers, Rebecca is a fabulous singer. Engineers, Mike, their last names don't come to me right now, but I know these guys, and songwriters. They're really good. So if you want your son, your daughter, your grandson, whatever, or if you yourself would like to experience this program. It's about a week long. You go in with nothing, and you come out with a CD of a song that you've written, recorded, and engineered, and it's really quite an experience. You can reach The Learning Shop at 914-835-1070. That's 914-835-1070. And they take good care of their people, whether they're tutoring them in academic subjects, helping them pass their SATs or their GEDs or whatever it may be, or just their classes. And then this great music program. They're really mellow. It's a pleasure to be there. That's The Learning Shop, Harrison, New York, 914-835-1070. And just one more little item I'd like to tell you about: this cabinet, which we call the Manhattan Clam. You can see it at themanhattanclam.com. It is a compact and beautiful furniture piece. It opens in seconds from a very low footprint. That's why it's called the clam. A very low footprint piece of furniture, which is against the wall, takes up, I don't know, a foot or two away from the wall. It's very attractive, and yet you can open it up, make a desk, a small table, or a large dinner party. You can seat, I don't know, up to nine, I think, and it's really good. The way to find out more about this is to go to themanhattanclam.com. Okay, we are chatting with Martin Ogle. We were talking about James Lovelock. James Lovelock is the originator of the Gaia Theory, along with Lynn Margulis, but James is generally given the credit. He originated it. He birthed it, if you will. And he is the one who has said that nuclear power is a good stopgap between going really green and to reduce our carbon footprint. Now, also, Martin, I'm going to ask you about this Dr. Patrick Moore. Have you ever heard of him?
I have, and in fact, I was fascinated to hear the ad before our segment started on nuclear energy.
Yes, we have a nuclear power plant in our area, which is very controversial. Its safety record, I don't know. They say that it has more problems than the average nuclear plant. I'm not in a position to confirm that or deny that. The fact is, it is so close to New York City, and there are so many millions of people within its reach that an accident there could be highly, highly catastrophic. It's Entergy that owns this. It's at Indian Point. I'm sure you've heard of Indian Point. It's a well-known nuclear plant and highly controversial. And in their ad, they say that Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, is all for, I'm not sure, nuclear energy. I guess nuclear energy. So what, you know, I've been trained by people that I listen to, you know, the environmentalists, that nuclear energy is dirty. It's prone to accidents. An accident can be absolutely catastrophic. How do we balance that? We use a lot of energy, and I don't see the human race backing up on its use of energy. What? I don't even have a question. Why don't you just talk about what I just said?
Well, it's interesting about us not backing up, because that's in fact what the not only the nuclear energy industry, but the whole energy industry is thinking of. I think even if you were to put aside the safety concerns, and I'm only doing this for sake of argument because I think that there are real concerns. If you were to put those aside, the fatal flaw as currently envisioned with nuclear energy is that it's not going to reduce global warming gases at all, because there's no real plan to make it become a larger and larger percentage of the energy we use. Skip Bowman of the Nuclear Energy Institute, for instance, said in response to a question at a talk that I went to, that in the future, say in future decades, as the number of new nuclear plants come online that they envision, that the percentage of nuclear energy would still remain about the same as it is now. In other words, about 20% of the total electricity production. So where is all that other electricity production going to come from? Well, unless we come up with some miracle, it's going to come from our existing sources, meaning that we're going to continue to pump out CO2 at ever-increasing amounts, not lower amounts.
Well, but we're reaching peak oil anyway, or we've already reached peak oil, part of which probably has to do with why we're paying so much for those products right now. Where's it going to come from? This is a finite resource. When it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah, well, oil is certainly problematic, but coal is left in vast quantities, and people are searching like crazy to find ways to make it cleaner. But nonetheless, there's going to be a long transition time in that, and who knows how ultimately successful we're going to be at reducing the total amounts of carbon dioxide released to the atmosphere.
So do we have a solution, or just the big question? Are there scientists that are working in any valid way to, I mean, when you burn coal, you have dirty carbon output. There's no magic.
Well, there certainly are all sorts of folks working on carbon sequestration, whether that be at the plant site or after it's already been released. And those are obviously needed. In other words, we need to figure out how to get some of the carbon out of the atmosphere that's already there, let alone future production. But I think the most promising and long-term successful scientific inquiry is going to be more social. It's going to be how can we as a society envision ways of doing things that in fact suit our purposes, in other words, that we're happy with, that reduce the total amount of energy used.
Well,
there are so many ways to do that.
Well, okay, there are, and Jimmy Carter got practically laughed out of the White House when he said, "Why don't you just turn your lights down and wear a sweater around the house?" Which to me makes perfect sense, and I live my life that way. I certainly don't keep a hot apartment. If it's cool, I put on a sweater. It doesn't bother me, but it bothered the hell out of a lot of Americans.
Yeah.
So, if a simple, practical, easy, inexpensive suggestion like that falls on deaf ears, how are you going to get people to stop driving everywhere they want to go and having to feed their kids less?
Well, I think largely it's a frame of mind, and I'm serious about largely, because it all has to do with the way it's framed. Right after he made that speech, people started using a term, freeze in the dark. Actually, it actually originated earlier than that in response to oil shale mining in Alberta, of all places. They said, let those Easterners freeze in the dark if they don't want to use our oil shale. But people started resurrecting that term again, implying that any attempts to live our lives differently that would use less energy would result in us freezing in the dark. And, of course, with that mindset, you're pretty unlikely to sway people's minds. However, what if we turned it on its head and said that what can we do creatively to make it so that we don't really suffer, at least it's not a necessity? One of the best examples that I ever saw was a display I saw in Oregon, and I really wish I remember where it was. It was a display with three different piles of the exact same building materials, and they constructed three houses out of those piles of building materials. And one was built in one manner, you know, facing the right way, with partially built into a hillside and other techniques. Others were built in more conventional ways, and the energy use between those three houses was vastly different. And so it's a design problem. It's a how can we put our best people to work on coming up with design of our entire society, really, not only individual buildings, but systems and transportation and where we live and work, et cetera, so that we can live good, satisfying, challenging lives without using so much energy.
Well, now you've struck on something I know something about. Do you know about the Earth ships? Well, the Earthship is a building that is designed exactly that way. The materials used are stuffed rubber tires which have been had dirt compacted by pounding it into the discarded tires. Those are the internal walls. The insulation factor is tremendous. They fill the cracks with cans and other recycled materials, and then of course they just put a wall over it so it looks like any other house. Mm-hmm. My brother has one in Tennessee, but my brother's a great environmentalist and naturalist, and I don't think you're going to get your average citizen to actually go that way. I mean, my brother Ken is the one guy who is most likely to take these things seriously, and he can live. Certainly, he'll wear tent sweaters if he has to. That's the kind of person he is. But the average American certainly isn't.
Well, it is seemingly a tall order, but societal trends have shifted quickly in the past, and I think that's what can give us hope. And in fact, we can also look around the world and see examples of societies that have made shifts quickly as well. Kind of policy decisions that were based on a larger and larger number of the citizens of those countries understanding the issue. Mm-hmm. For instance, Japan and Germany, of all places, rather cloudy, high-latitude Germany, have long since passed us up in terms of solar energy and other renewable energy. And, we're talking total amount here, not just percentage.
Right.
And so that shows us that human beings have it in them to at least move in the right direction. I wouldn't necessarily say that they're sustainable societies either at this point in time, but we can all move more quickly in the right direction if we understand what the issue is and how to best do it. That's actually why I'm so excited about the Gaia theory, or I should say it's one of the reasons, because to me it's the best understanding of how these systems work and how we, our role in it, or how we fit in.
And you're actually very active in that. When you go to the Gaia Theory website, you're prominent there. I have there was a Gaia conference that you had something to do with in October 2006 at George Mason University Law School in Arlington, Virginia, and I believe Lynn Margulis was your keynote speaker, and right. Jim Lovelock prepared a video for that event. Can you give us a minute about that?
Sure. It was a great event, actually. We had over 200 folks there, and it appeared that everyone was extremely energized by this event. We got rave reviews, I must say, and Lynn Margulis was our keynote, but we had about 20 speakers from all over the country, really, talking not only about the Gaia theory per se, but also different ways that people are starting to see relationships to other questions, for instance, in energy and in social things. There's a historian of the Gaia theory. There's a fellow at, I might get it wrong here, Penn State or University of Pennsylvania, I believe it's Penn State, that is studying termite mounds in Africa and sees this as this microcosm of how a system would work, where in the termite mound, for instance, there are ants that are literally farming fungus, and the interaction, the symbiosis between these two, and how the ants or how the termites construct their termite mound yields a very steady level of humidity and temperature. And he says, wow, this is a mechanism for how we can understand how a much larger system, Earth in this case, works as a system as well.
Well, I think you're speaking of the leaf cutter ant, are you not?
No, leaf cutters are in South America, and they don't make these tremendous mounds, but the termites in Africa make these mounds in which they actually have this temperature and humidity control. The point there was that we just had so many different speakers looking at systems in different ways, everything from the very minute all the way on up to how Earth operates as a system.
Well, the leaf cutters do the same thing, though. They farm fungus, which is their food.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah, they cut the leaves and take them down, and if they use that to farm fungus, I was not aware.
Yeah, I believe that's what they do. Mm-hmm. Let me just take a quick break here, and then I have a couple of questions, burning questions, which I must ask you. You are listening to Environmentally Sound on WVOX AM 1460, originating in New Rochelle. If you are listening near the Shafly River in Louisiana, the Nile River in Africa, the Mississippi River in Missouri, or on the Tallahatchie Bridge, you have logged on to www.wvox.com, and you are listening live to Environmentally Sound with my guest, Martin Ogle, who is the chief naturalist at the Northern Virginia Regional Park Authority. He's been there since 85, which by my math is 23 years. What a long time to have a job.
Right.
Okay, here's a couple of questions that I have to ask you. First of all, salamanders. You call them advanced salamanders. They have no gills, they have no lungs, and yet they do actually take oxygen in, and they do actually function as living creatures. In fact, more advanced than those that breathe air. They're considered evolutionarily ahead of others. Is that correct?
Well, the word advanced is not mine. It's
right.
What they're sometimes referred to, and actually lungless is probably the better term. It simply says that they evolved away from having lungs, and then they now, this large group of salamanders, breathes through their skin. And the reason that was fascinating to me, among other examples, is that evolution doesn't always go in one direction, so to speak. Sometimes things get big and then revert to small. They might evolve out of the ocean and then return to the ocean. Some plants evolve chlorophyll, and then later plants afterwards might evolve to a point where they've lost the ability to photosynthesize.
Well,
there's examples like that all over the place.
What's interesting to me is we consider ourselves the most highly evolved creatures, and yet salamanders have come to where we are having lungs, and they've gone beyond that, or like again, whether it's beyond or lateral move. But they have decided that lungs were not their most efficient way of gaining oxygen, and we have not yet come to that. That's what kind of tickles my fancy.
It's just you can look at evolution as whatever works, and if it doesn't work, it fades to the wayside. But for instance, there's some theories as to where these salamanders evolved, and one of them is that they actually evolved in the Appalachian Mountains and in mountainous areas where there was cold flowing water, and that in that kind of environment, they could actually breathe better through their skin than using lungs, and there'd be certain disadvantages to having lungs. So they, over time, lost their lungs and became skin breathers.
And they're still amphibians, of course. They're just what salamanders are, except that they no longer have lungs. And they breathe through, you call it diffusion rather than osmosis. Am I just misusing the word osmosis? That's kind of an internal thing, isn't it?
Yeah, osmosis is across a membrane, so I guess you could say the same thing, but it's the oxygen is able to diffuse into the body through sacs, little tiny sacs that are kept moist by mucous membranes.
Okay. Well, so I'll have to maybe do a little private research. Let's talk about the Aberdeen testing ground in Maryland. This is a radioactive, potentially radioactive place, nuclear weapons, or at least nuclear devices, were tested there. And when it was over, the eagles flourished, and that's really not the fact of the nuclear radiation. Is not as important as the fact of the lack of human beings. Is that?
Well, actually, Aberdeen wasn't a nuclear testing ground. It was used for testing of various artillery and stuff like that.
Okay.
Still is, and also it is still the home of a lot of chemical, and I don't know if they're also biological, but at least chemicals that were left over from World War II. And so it's been used for various military purposes over long periods of time. But yes, within that context, with even today bombs going or tanks being fired, et cetera, there is a flourishing population of eagles. Of course, the reason this is coming up is that I worked there before I worked with the Regional Park Authority, and it's always a kind of an interesting irony that in the midst of certain things that you might find extremely environmentally unfriendly, you find those areas are great wildlife refuges, and that's often the case because that military use has precluded other human development that really gets rid of the habitat of those animals.
And in fact, Jim Lovelock uses that also in his book, The Revenge of Gaia, where He says that even in places where there have been nuclear accidents like Chernobyl, animals that have survived, obviously many have died, but those that have survived thrive in that environment.
Yeah. Well, the fact that in certain areas where human activity slows down or is completely precluded, the fact that that encourages wildlife shouldn't distract us from the overall picture of what energy use as a whole does to living systems. If our question was, can we create small pockets of better wildlife refuge, you know, by X or Y method of energy production, then, you know, that would be a significant fact. Mm-hmm. But it's really a sidelight, I think.
Yeah. Now, you've come to being a naturalist from an unusual route, actually. Your father was a Methodist missionary, am I correct?
That's right.
And you were born and raised in South Korea. And you just actually came back from a trip there. I don't know, was that business, pleasure, family? What was that?
Actually went to a conference where the topic was interpreting our cultural heritage, and had the opportunity to present a paper on the Gaia theory and the reasons why I think it's so tied in with our cultural heritage.
And you, I presume, are fluent in the Korean language.
Oh, that I were. I was when I was little, but I forgot most of it, and I was able to get just enough to get around the country.
So you have to tell me, since kimchi is served with everything, do you really like kimchi?
I love kimchi.
Do you? Kimchi to our audience is kind of a sauerkraut that's buried in the ground, isn't it?
Yeah, traditional food of Korea, but...
It's like pickle, isn't it, or is it an actual dish?
Well, it's pickled, it's fermented, it's also extremely hot and a lot of garlic, so that's what kind of puts some Western tongues off, but it's a pickled cabbage dish.
But you love it.
I love it.
So how did you become a naturalist then, if you were born to a family that made its living, I suppose, by the cloth?
Well, interesting. I mean, I think that there are certain things that are unknowable in that. I mean, I don't know what's in my own character that led me in different directions, but part of it certainly has to do with our childhood experiences. And my father used to take us kids hiking in the mountains. Korea is a very mountainous country, mm-hmm. and I fell in love with that early on and loved to be outside. And then we came back to the United States twice, and when we did, we came to Madison, Wisconsin. And one of my loves then was fishing. And so as a child, I spent just unending hours out on the lakes in Wisconsin fishing. So those things certainly contributed to my love of nature and understanding how it works.
And I'm guessing that your father does not approve of your profession. That's just a guess.
No, I would say he's in full support of my profession.
Oh, really?
Absolutely.
Even though the more you get closer to the earth and the more of a scientist you are, the more you have to, I think, doubt religion. Am I on a limb here?
Well, I think that's a highly personal thing, and I think everyone would answer it different, and so I wouldn't even presume to answer it for my father, let alone anyone else. As far as I'm concerned, I think that it's not necessarily, it can certainly be, but it's not necessarily a conflict between what one thinks in religious terms about what God is or isn't, and then how the world works as a whole.
Hmm. Well, I'm fond of asking people, would you fly in an airplane that was built by a preacher, or was your iPhone made by a rabbi? You know, because scientists seek the truth, but religionists know the truth.
Yeah.
They know it, and as we discussed also, as the people that I talk to that are adamant about religion, they believe so fervently that they think I am totally wrong. And I think they're totally wrong to put mm-hmm. so much into religion. And so how can we possibly know? I guess those are the questions that we can never answer, and we just try to be as diplomatic as possible. Isn't that right?
Well, I think there's also viewpoints that I think that people have talked a lot about how the two realms don't overlap. So you wouldn't want your preacher designing your plane, but you wouldn't want your plane designer officiating at a ceremony of great importance where one had to be kind of really practiced and into the whole life cycle of people on this planet and what it means to be alive and where we're going afterwards,
well,
et cetera.
I guess not, Martin. And we must say goodbye, but it's been very stimulating. And thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Bye now. I'd like to thank Martin Ogle for spending his time with us today. To be a naturalist, one almost has to feel the pulse of the beat of the earth. When you are tuned into the natural world, it does by its very nature become a living, breathing thing. And the whole idea of Gaia, the earth as an evolutionary construct without which none of us would have the extraordinary mystical gift of life, is the greatest miracle imaginable. Our thought for the week: if we all did the things we are capable of doing, we would literally astound ourselves. Stay tuned. Howard Sturman, a man who by his very presence makes all our lives worthwhile. Thank you very much for listening. Remember to be kind.
This is the flagship station of Whitney Media, live from New York.